I next met with Dr. Charles Geyer from Massey Cancer Center in Richmond, Virginia, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
She's 69, probably heavier than she ought to be for her overall health, and so she had non-insulin-dependent diabetes, fibromyalgia, and also degenerative arthritis. So she came in with sort of a lot of musculoskeletal kind of chronic problems, with a strong sentiment that she did not want to undergo chemotherapy unless it was necessary. The thing was a little unusual about her is her primary tumor was only 1 centimeter in size, but she had a larger metastatic lymph node that was 3.9 by 2.7 on ultrasound. Biopsy demonstrated a grade 2 infiltrating ductal carcinoma that was strongly ER positive, relatively weakly on PR positivity, and HER2 negative. We also cored the lymph node and it showed the same thing. Imaging showed basically that it supported the physical findings. We had a relatively small primary with what appeared to be a single lymph node involved, at least on imaging. So we saw her for the possibility of what about neoadjuvant therapy, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, even neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, and basically decided that in her case, we thought that let's go ahead and do the surgery. Technically, there was no problem to doing the surgery, and that would then get us as much prognostic information as we could. We would learn if that one large lymph node was indeed the only lymph node, or if there were multiple other occult nodes involved that might do things.
I'm kind of curious, just, you know, sort of taking a step back from this case, this patient presenting clinically with gross axillary node involvement, how would you have approached her if the ER and HER2 had been different? How would you have approached her if she'd had a HER2 positive tumor? How would you have approached her if she had a triple negative tumor?
Yeah, well, those, you're describing a situation where we would have moved into neoadjuvant therapy. I mean, for the most part, once you have axillary lymph node involvement, and if your primary tumor is 2 centimeters or greater in general, thinking when we have a triple negative breast cancer, a HER2 positive breast cancer, and to some extent, you know, an ER positive tumor, but a weakly ER positive tumor, we tend to generally go with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The thing that, you know, backed us off in this case was the strong ER positivity. And then her strong desire to really understand, okay, how much is chemotherapy really going to help reduce my risk? Because we discussed it and she articulated that an absolute 2%, 3%, 4% to her just didn't seem like it was worthwhile. So she was needing to know that the chemotherapy was really necessary and would provide what she considered to be substantial benefit. So this is an unusual case. It's kind of why I picked it. It's not a typical way that we would manage a patient with a 1 centimeter primary and a relatively large axillary node.
This case also brings up the issue of management of the axilla in patients receiving neoadjuvant therapy. Now, of course, if she had had a tumor, again, triple negative, HER2 positive, more benefit from neoadjuvant chemotherapy might have been more likely, where the chance of having a significant response both in the breast and axilla would be much greater. I'm curious at your center how you're approaching the axilla in these patients, both those who present with clinically negative axilla. What do you do diagnostically and therapeutically after neoadjuvant therapy, and those who present like she does with gross disease in the axilla?
Sure. With somebody clinically node negative, meaning, of course, negative on exam, but also negative imaging, but with a primary tumor that we feel we want to treat with neoadjuvant therapy, our surgeons will perform a post-chemotherapy sentinel node biopsy and then act accordingly based on those results. If they have a large number of lymph nodes or bulky lymph nodes, we're tending to still go ahead and do axillary dissection. If it's a relatively, you know, not too bulky of disease and you have normalization of the lymph nodes on imaging, then we do also perform sentinel node biopsy there. It's one that the surgeons kind of make a decision on a case-by-case basis, but for the most part, the effort is to try to use neoadjuvant therapy not only to spare the extent of breast surgery, but also spare the extent of the axillary surgery. So unless there are pre-existing reasons, such as very bulky or extensive known axillary adenopathy, we will attempt sentinel node biopsy as long as patients have had a clear response. If there's still abnormal imaging, and then we'll tend to go ahead and do a dissection.
Also, in those patients who have clinically negative axilla, they have response to neoadjuvant therapy, you do a sentinel node biopsy and you find a positive sentinel node, do you then go to axillary dissection or do you employ sort of the Z11 non-dissection approach?
The Z11 non-approach is generally something that we will pursue. Again, there's an overriding sense that we want to avoid a full dissection unless we clearly need to do so. And we are, of course, participating in the clinical trials that are trying to work out additional questions in those patients as well.
Another question about the patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative disease is the issue of, you mentioned earlier, potentially neoadjuvant hormonal therapy. Now, this lady wasn't in a situation where she needed, tumor shrinkage to get breast conservation. Other patients maybe can be in that situation. She had pretty bulky disease. But is there any role, from your point of view, to looking at genomic assays as a way to decide whether or not to give neoadjuvant therapy, whether to give neoadjuvant endocrine therapy? And I'm curious, maybe you can comment on the work by Dr. Harry Baer that reported results from a study, a smaller study, looking at this strategy.
It's something, again, that we talk about the information. I personally think these genomic assays that we have now in breast cancer really do provide very useful information on the relative potential merits of chemotherapy versus endocrine therapy. And so, Matt Ellis's work that he did with ACOSOG and subsequently with Alliance, and that really showed that there are a subset of patients who come to you with a strongly ER-positive cancer. So you have to have that high all-red score, and not all pathology departments report all-red scores, but it basically means that a very high percentage of your cells have a lot intense staining for ER. So the patients who appear based on estrogen receptor staining to be likely to have a response, I think, are reasonable candidates, particularly if you have information that tells you that you would like to offer avoidance of chemotherapy to a patient because her clinical risks appear to be relatively low to, moderately low. I think it's a real advantage. It's clear from his long-term follow-up on his data that patients who have suppression of their Ki-67 at the 4-week mark and then sustain it out to 12 to 14 weeks do extremely well with endocrine therapy alone, particularly if when you operate, they have negative lymph node involvement. He calls that PEPE score. And basically what you're looking for there are patients to have negative nodes and tumor size under 5 centimeters with very low Ki-67. That group of patients should do very, very well with endocrine therapy and probably be spared. It's a relatively small subset of the patients, maybe 20-25%, but that's an important subset. So I think it's something that I don't think we do enough of in this country, frankly, looking at that possibility in properly selected patients. I think if patients have clearly extensive axillary disease, if they don't have that higher all-red score, and you're probably going to want to give them chemotherapy that they're probably not going to get down to a PEPI zero, then I tend to be a little more inclined to going to the chemotherapy, as do most of my colleagues here at Massey, I think, from our discussions that we have.
Are you familiar with the work that Harry Baer reported?
Yeah, Harry's study. He did that as one of our investigator-initiated trials with a number of other centers, basically getting the oncotype and then looking at the adjusted medium risk group, randomizing those patients with scores 12 to 25 to either get neoadjuvant endocrine therapy or neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And it was really a feasibility study that he wanted to do to see if patients would be comfortable with that kind of a randomization based on a core biopsy. And then, of course, did you get comparable outcomes in terms of breast conservation rates, things like that? And basically what the study showed was, yeah, that when you have that patient cohort with that Oncotype DX recurrence score 11 to 25, they seem to do just about as well in terms of breast conservation rates, response rates, as you get with chemotherapy. No PCRs with either one. The PCRs in the study were all high recurrence score patients, which is kind of what you'd expect, you know, based on what we've learned from the Oncotype DX score from multiple other studies.
I'm curious if there are any situations outside of a trial setting right now where in an ER-positive, HER2-negative tumor, you might order a genomic assay. And the one that I wonder about is a patient who really wants to have breast conservation, but right now it's kind of on the borderline cosmetically in terms of ratio of tumor versus breast, where you really want to shrink it down. Is that a situation where you would use a genomic assay, or do you just sort of go to chemotherapy?
I think, so you would be talking, I guess your patient doesn't have a real strong PEPE score, have that strong 6 to 8, so you've got somebody where you're not quite as sure, maybe a ER 5 to 6, that sort of a thing. So you're looking for a little more information to guide you in that regard, make sure it's not a high recurrence score. I mean, in our discussions, that tends to be sort of where we will go when we're looking at these sorts of questions. So we don't do it a lot. You know, Harry's got interest in it, and we will do it, but not as a routine at all. Because I think what you're looking for, again, to me as a medical oncologist, I like to get my chemotherapy in first if I'm going to have to give it. Unless I've got a situation where there's a good chance I can avoid it in this patient using Matt's approach, I know that if they don't suppress, I'll know it pretty quickly and we can go on then and give them chemotherapy and we're sure about it. So I guess I tend to personally kind of like the approach they're doing in the alternate trial, basically to look at the PEPE scores and then go ahead and try. I think if you're on the fence, if you're needing a little bit more information, I mean, to me, a lot of this, the thing that I find interesting, you know, about the genomic assays is they've been developed and tested in very specific situations that I think are approved and they provide definite useful information that you pretty much want to do in every patient. But as we see the biology and what these genomic assays are telling us about breast cancer, you can see these other situations where they can also inform and help arrive at a more individualized and specific decision. So I think that is an option that comes up. You know, are we having a struggle here because of some specifics about this case? Looking at endocrine therapy versus chemo, is the patient undecided? If it'd be nice to have additional information, sure. Again, you do get into the reimbursement issues and those sorts of things that always potentially can come up. But we do order them time to time, but I wouldn't say it's a routine thing that we now do before we do neoadjuvant endocrine therapy.
So what happened with this patient?
We had talked to her about getting the Oncotype DX score, and at that time, the responder study was actively accruing, and she was interested and agreed to have Oncotype testing performed on the trial. Interestingly enough, her score came back 20, so she fit the randomization portion of the trial.
Can you maybe take a step back and go through what was seen at surgery with her and then what the RxPONDER trial actually is?
Okay, sure. At surgery, basically, we found that indeed she did have a solitary 1 centimeter primary tumor. And at axillary dissection, she had 13 nodes removed, and the only one that had tumor in it was the enlarged lymph node that we had seen on ultrasound measuring 2.4 centimeters. So the responder trial basically is a study that is being led by SWOG, basically looking at the role of the Oncotype DX recurrence score for guiding adjuvant therapy in patients with ER-positive breast cancer with 1 to 3 positive nodes. And so because she had the one node positive, that made her eligible for the responder trial, and she agreed to enter the study. The study basically, if you have a score above 25, then you're recommended to receive chemotherapy with endocrine therapy. Below 25, then that's the randomization between chemotherapy followed by endocrine therapy or endocrine therapy alone. And so we talked with her about the results. And again, as we went over, she was very interested in the absolute numbers and how likely, how much reduction was there. And she ultimately decided that she didn't view the score of 20 as being all that bad, and it was pretty close to 17. And I think she made an informed decision that for her, endocrine therapy alone would be sufficient. And so that's what we did. The interesting wrinkle on her, though, is that with this node positivity and that score in the intermediate range at 20, I did feel like she was a patient that endocrine therapy should consist of an aromatase inhibitor. But as she went through the surgery, her fibromyalgia really flared and she was having a lot of pain. And I was concerned about her compliance, tolerance to the aromatase inhibitors. So we talked about bridging therapy by going to fulvestrant. So we put her on the fulvestrant. I was sort of envisioning maybe 4 to 6 months. She tolerated it so well. It took about 15 months before she was ready to switch to the AI. And so we now have her on the AI. And now she's doing well, you know, very compliant with medication. Because I did feel like since all of our therapy was going to be endocrine therapy, that we really needed to make sure we had optimal therapy there.
And what's her current situation right now?
She's in follow-up. I think she's, 2.5 years out, doing well. She actually tolerated the conversion to the letrozole quite well. Our rheumatologist had to go through a number of different agents, or enough time had to pass for the fibromyalgia to settle down, but she's actually doing quite well at this point.
Can you kind of take a step back and provide an overview of what we know about the use of genomic assays in early breast cancer, and including the use in node-positive situations, and talk about the various assays? This lady had the 21 gene score and was part of the trial that was looking at more at that, but there's also the 70 gene score, the PAM50. Maybe kind of provide a little bit of an overview of that.
Yeah, sure. I think the study that she had, the Oncotype DX recurrence score, clearly is one of the multigene assays that has been the most extensively studied. And it basically now is considered, I think, one of the standards for patients with node-negative, ER-positive breast cancer patients. And for me, as a medical oncologist, the thing that makes it extremely important, you know, is that we really can identify patients who are going to do very well with endocrine therapy alone and clearly would derive no benefit from chemotherapy. I think that's been the real important contribution that Oncotype has made. Oncotype from the beginning was developed using formalin fixed paraffin embedded tissue, so it was easy to do retrospective trials on older data sets like NSABP B14, B20, our node negative trials, B28, node positive trials. Southwest Oncology Group did studies. There's been a number of early studies that showed that the utility of the assay being able to work in paraffin really facilitated development. The 70 gene panel, the MammaPrint, was initially developed and had to be conducted on frozen tissues. So there were a lot of logistical barriers that really made development of that quite challenging. Now, since then, it's now available on formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue, but the volume of data from clinical studies, I think, clearly lags what is there with the Oncotype DX recurrence score. The risk of recurrence score is another one based on intrinsic subtyping, the PAM50. Again, it is a newer one on the block, and so the database of studies is not as extensive. But I think when there have been efforts made to directly in different ways compare these assays, and I think they're all really looking at the same things in breast cancer. You know, how dependent is this cancer on the estrogen receptor pathway? What is this cancer's proliferation rate? And because they seem to provide very, very similar information to me, but I tend to use the study, I guess, with the most data. I will have to admit, because I'm one of the authors on the original Oncotype DX score looking at chemotherapy, I'm on the Taylor X steering committee, I do have biases that I have to acknowledge, but I think it has been a remarkably consistent test in terms of its utility and reproducibility. To me, it's gone from different data sets, different trials, different populations, and consistently you really see that it performs quite well at finding these patients who just clearly do not need and should not receive chemotherapy. And again, the others, I think, probably are doing the same thing. You always get down to, okay, in my clinic with my patient, which one will I do? I tend to try to use the same tools repeatedly. I feel like I get a better feel for them than jumping from assay to assay. So I tend to primarily utilize the Oncotype DX recurrence score when I'm trying to address that early chemotherapy yes or no question in my ER positive patients.
Another situation where genomic assays have been discussed and studied is in patients who are receiving hormone therapy, again, ER positive, HER2 negative situation, and reach the 5-year point. Can you talk about what we know about genomic assays there, and do you yourself utilize them in your practice?
Again, it's a very competitive area. There are actually, I guess, 4 assays that one can consider using in that space. It's an interesting area because so far, ASCO has decided that the data isn't sufficiently strong to recommend any of the assays for routine clinical use. I personally don't agree with that. I mean, what ASCO is trying to do is objectively look for a certain level of evidence where you can clearly say the evidence is so clear, so compelling, this really should be a standard of care. And I think that's an important thing that we need for practical reasons. That oftentimes is what third-party payers will use to determine if you can obtain a study in your patient cohort. But I think when you really look at the challenges that we have in trying to develop biomarkers for long-term estrogen deprivation therapy, in patients where we have this long, long natural history that, you know, extends out to 10, 20 years. I think it was San Antonio 2015 where the Oxford folks showed their long-term follow-up data on patients who had just received 5 years of endocrine therapy. Most of them had received tamoxifen. Many of them had not received chemotherapy who would now, but you know, the striking thing about those curves that they showed is just that the recurrences just seem to keep happening out there years 5 to 10, 10 to 15, 15 to 20, you know, and so it's a very difficult area to insist that you have prospective studies that are designed to determine utility over a 20-year period. I mean, you just get to this practicality issue is my concern.